all just go inside now and just search the heart for that desire and intention to love, to please something greater than yourself, and just pray. Hear the sincerity of the heart. That sincerity of the heart to want to please the divine without any motive, without any desire for anything in return. That's bhakti. And when we chant the holy name, we try to find that voice and pray that that voice becomes louder and louder and louder. There are so many voices in our hearts. Think of all the voices for selfishness. I want revenge, I want this, I don't like. Find that voice. And when that voice becomes louder and louder and louder, until it comes to the point of tears, and that's pure devotion. And the great souls, all they have in that heart is that voice amplified to the greatest degree. And in that regard, why don't we just do 1 5-minute meditation on that voice, listening to the sincerity. I want you to hear every syllable, relish every syllable. I want you to feel the name and your response to it, which is devotion. I want you to hear the sincerity of the name, of the mantra in your heart, praying, oh the divine, oh energy of the divine, please engage me in your service. I want you to chant it with love, to please, so chant it sweetly. And I want you to cry out for all that is great, all that is pure. And when you feel chanting every syllable, and you feel it attracting the selflessness and devotion in your heart, which is the greatest gift, I want you to feel a drop of gratitude. And I want you to hear gratitude in the form of that mantra. And now you can put your hands before your heart and feel that mantra, the gratitude of the heart, which is the symptom of the soul. Feel it through the hands. And pray that we always may be humble, we may be grateful, and we can meditate on the mantra of the holy name, but also a description of it by Lord Chaitanya. Once you chant the holy name of the Lord in a humble state of mind, thinking oneself lower than the straw in the street, more tolerant than a tree, devoid of all sense of false prestige, ready to offer all respects to others. And you can offer just general gratitude in the mantra for the name, for this seminar, to the people who helped make the seminar possible. And just offer your gratitude in the form of the name. And now, with your hands in that mudra, which says that these hands, which have been directed selfishly, will now be offered selflessly. One definition of bhakti is to make yourself available for service. So your prayer in that mantra now could be to make yourself available for service. Okay, you can now open your eyes, but keep that consciousness. Don't let the vrittis of me, I, selfishness. And now in a prayerful mood, we'll hear more, a little bit more philosophy, and we'll continue our understanding of bhakti. Humbly joined our kirtan band. And she's a product of the kirtan camp. Thank Nirav. He keeps a very good beat. He's, Indian family from Kansas. And somehow he met some Krishna devotees there and came here in the Bhakti Center to be trained. So when I came back to the ashram, I had to find a drummer. I had to find an engine for our program. So how God arranges things. So I left there. I didn't know who was going to be the drummer, because the other one was driving someone else to the Radha Govinda Mandir. There's an incredibly sweet godbrother of mine here now. A real bhakta. He's my favorite kirtanir, by the way. Yeah. His name is Urjaswat. And all I can say, he's a purified version of Louis Armstrong. When he leads kirtans, the sweat comes from his head and he kind of pats it with a cloth. In fact, he was giving class this morning, and there, and I was staying someplace else, and my godbrother, who's a Sanskrit scholar to the greatest degree, who also is one of the teachers here in Yoga Maya, his name is Paul Sherbaugh. His name was Pradyumna. This person is as learned as he can be. And he's like this with me. He called me up, and he's a great scholar. And he said, wow, that was such a wonderful class. And it wasn't a scholarly class. It was a class of realization. He was talking about you're not the body, but from realization, because he had a stroke. And he realized you can't identify with the body. And so heartfelt. Anyway, I lost the drummer. So I went back to where I was staying, and good old Jason, he arranged some lunch for me, and then he said, Nirav will bring a tiffin for you from the ashram. So I said, well, Nirav, okay, he can play drum, but he can only play drum until 6:30. But we got him enough. But Nirav, thank you for coming.
Thank you so much.
It's a seminar on drama as yoga. And then we can do some prayerful reading. you can read, I wrote a commentary, I'm writing a book now on bhakti from this seminar. So you can read that, and then you can share among yourselves a little bit, you know, revitalize what you studied, your realizations. So I think we can do that. I'm waiting to grin because the nature of discussion is you have to speak to one mind. So everybody has to be here together. So I'll wait a few minutes. That is a few points also to discuss. Any questions? Bryn, I'm explaining the strategy for today.
Okay.
Yeah, and what I'm going to do is, because I mentioned, they really have a lot of information. So what we're going to do is, I'm going to finish up at least a section or two of the Narada Bhakti Sutras. And I'm going to go through the whole thing with the paradigm I set with the hands. Okay, and remember the idea is that these are sutras, so by now, you should be able to unpack them a little bit. And then what we're going to do is we'll discuss aesthetics and bhakti. Also explain about Krishna, I guess, and also about Radha. And then about 11 o'clock at night. Then we'll do this prayerful reading. So, okay, here we'll go. Right? So look at the hands, okay? So this is reality. Reality is God in the center, and we're a particle of consciousness, part of the divine. The part is meant for service. Bhakti is when you have that mood of service, when you're in your natural position, right? You see yourself as an object for the pleasure of God. Now, what happens when you don't want to be what you are? You can't be everything. You're part of everything. But when you want to be the enjoyer and controller, that only can be fulfilled in illusion. So what happens in illusion, this pure soul, which has a mood of service, becomes in the illusion that it's the center. And its consciousness is reflected on the body. And because the body is temporary and it's changing, the soul suffers. The soul is pure. Right? And how does Pantanjali define ignorance? It's when the pure, eternal, and blissful soul identifies with the temporary, impure, miserable body. This is the cause of our problem. It's a desire not to be a devotee. That's causing our problem. We're identifying with this. So now we have three things. We have God, totality, the divine, Brahman, Ishvara, the absolute. We have the soul, and we have matter. Matter exists. The illusion is we're identifying with it. It's one of God's energies. So when you want to engage in devotional service, you have to have a little right conception. And what is the right conception? Well, the first right concept, you have to understand the relationship between God, the soul, and the body. Matter, spirit, the controller of both. So first, you understand, I'm not this. And a lot of spiritual teaching is to tell you that. You're not this. You're different. And that spiritual life means to get out of this, you may have to work through this. You may have to work through your desires. You may have to regulate your desires to be peaceful. But you're not this.
If you think you're this, then what happens? You don't have bhakti. Why? Because bhakti doesn't flow from the center. Bhakti doesn't flow from the conception that I am the enjoyer and controller. So the first knowledge is, I'm not this. I don't identify with this. Because if I identify with this, the extent I identify with this is the extent that I miss love. Love flows here, not in ego. Then you have to have the understanding that the soul is not God. It's a part of God. Because if you think you're God, then what's the question of love? Love is a relationship. And you have to understand that God is not matter. It's not material. Okay, so the next thing says, now we will describe bhakti. Now the second verse, its nature is divine love, that selfless intention. And now the next point is, you can look at the hands, because it's all in the hands. The next point is, this position of bhakti, of the soul, the relationship to divine love, is eternal. That means you're eternal. It means that love is eternal. It's not that you perform bhakti and then in the future there's something else. Like you perform gyan, then you become liberated. You perform the activity to get the fruit or the goal. That means what you're doing is not blissful. In jnana, you perform all austerities because you want something better. But love is not done for anything else but itself. So it's therefore described in Bhagavad Gita that bhakti is susukam kartam avyayam. It's a very blissful path. Now it says what? Attaining this divine love, a person becomes perfect, immortal, and satisfied. Because what's perfection? Perfection is what you are, and getting rid of everything else that's added to it. What's external to it. So when you come to that point, you're perfect, it's real, it's eternal, and you're satisfied. And why are you satisfied? Because there is harmony between who you are and what you're doing. You're the part of God that's meant for service. The hand is a part, it functions for the whole. When the hand functions for the whole, it's satisfied. Not only it's satisfied, everyone's satisfied. So when you link up with the universal desire, and you can actually link in with that and try to satisfy and please the universal desire, whether it comes in different moral principles, etc., whatever you do will be beneficial for everyone and yourself. And then achieving this, all fervor of desire and regret are no more. Because once you fill your heart with love, you're satisfied. The fervor stops. The search stops. You know, I was trying to help one person coming to Krishna consciousness that was a heroin addict. And he said I was very sincere, but he had a terrible addiction. Just laughing because anyway, I won't say what I'm laughing about, but some other time. But so I tried to help him, and he went to Narcotics Anonymous, and it was helping him. So I said, okay, explain to me what the principles are. So I heard what the principles are, and then I figured out how it worked. How does it work? What's addiction? You're feeling a lack in your heart, usually of love, and it's so intense that want is so intense that you're seeking to fill that with something. And bless her heart, Achyuta Gopi, such a little young scholar, she gave such a nice example we had yesterday, that the heart, the thing that's missing is shaped like the divine in our service for the divine, and you do other things, they don't fit to satisfy that lacking. So I thought, what is Narcotics Anonymous? First you admit you're helpless, right? And then somehow you accept a power greater than yourself. So I figured out the way it works is these people, you know, they're brought to a position of humility. Right? And then the practice reinforces that humility. They have to say, I can't control myself. There's a power greater than me. So what happens is that humility that they have and that accepting a higher power allows them to experience the love that they were missing that was causing the addiction. We discussed this too when you came to my yoga fest. The yogis do the bhakti fest and the bhaktis do the yoga fest. You went to my, and I spoke on that point of gratitude, right? And what happens is when you receive something, if you have a sense of entitlement, you don't feel any love when you get it, no matter what it is. So the greater you value something, and the less qualified you feel to have it, the more love you feel. So when a person actually admits that I'm helpless, he starts to feel some devotion. So when one is actually in a humble position and his heart's filled with love, he becomes satisfied. Then it says, realizing it, one becomes intoxicated, stunned, and self-blissful. Because what really happens is when we realize that we are part of the divine and actually embrace that. Look what happens. Look. We're only connected to this because we don't want to be a devotee. We don't want to be a servant. We don't want to be humble. Right? We want this. We want the attachment to the body because it gives us that sense of ego. So what's the connection? The connection is an attitude. When you give up the attitude, you're free from the connection. The illusion follows our desire not to be what we want. Ah, when you finally desire to be a soul, to be self-realized, to understand who we are, and you start to think and act that way, and actually become that, then you stop identifying with the body. And there's a verse in Bhagavad Gita, it's a beautiful verse. It says, Daivi Esha Gunamayi Mama Maya Daratya Mameviye Papantyante. This energy that puts us in illusion that we're separate from everything, that energy is divine. Why are we in illusion? Because we want to be. Because we don't want to be a servant. We don't want to be humble. So that energy is following our desire. If you don't give up that desire, you can't become liberated from bodily attachment, etc. That's why bhakti is so powerful, because it's the process that gets right at the desire. It reverses the desire that causes the illusion. So it says, and one who surrenders to me, you easily cross over. But when you come in that point, then I describe what is actually your function. And then I describe what? That the Supreme has two, that absolute reality, its pleasure is love, and has two types. Sarupananda, its very nature is pleasurable. I describe like swinging on a hammock. And it has the pleasure of love, which is the essence of its bliss potency. These are technical terms, not so relevant here. But you think about it, if the absolute reality has bhaktanam, then what's our function? To hold that energy of love in our heart and direct it back. It has to come from outside. You have to. So God, within God, He has distinction for the purpose of love. And that's our job, to be a receptacle. So that's what this verse says. When you actually realize this, you feel the highest pleasure. And we described, I have a book out there, Waves of Devotion. Sarah looked at it and said, this is a little too technical. What I learned. But it describes that science. And it's amazing. And one is in that state, it describes a ram vatasa priya nama kritya. When one in kirtan has that relationship with the name, without inhibition, without any attachment, chitanu raga, from that comes that energy of devotion. And one experiences so many ecstatic emotions. Now, after it described that, it says, such emotions are not worldly, for divine love abandons all worldly desires. So when your heart is filled with that love, even though there's so many emotions coming, you're completely detached. So that love has nothing to do with worldly desires. And then it says, renunciation of worldly desires specifically means abandoning the worldliness of duty and religion. We discussed that this morning. We don't perform any activities, religious activities, for fruitive gains. There's so much religion like that. You only perform activities that increase your desire to love and serve without any expectation. And Lord Chaitanya, he wrote those eight verses. He's the father of Sankirtan. And that last verse says, Ashlisha Ba Padaratam Panastama Madarshanam Mama. You may make me broken hearted by not being present before me. You may crush me by your embrace, but you're still my Lord. So you have that kind of thing. And then it says, What does that mean? It means you found your shelter. That's your faith. We talked about this morning. What is your faith? It's your trust in what will give you sublimity based on your experience that it's doing so. Right? Whatever you do, you have some trust, but a lot of times you're disappointed. Right? People take, wow, intoxication, heroin, this will make me ecstatic. I have faith in it. Let me take it. Let me get more. But then they're disappointed at the end. So to be happy, you have to have
here to here, like in a jump. But like for me, like I notice, like when I look at this, I'm like, I give up everything and fervors and regret, and I'm like, wow, I'm so far. But when I think about like myself, whatever, a couple years ago, I see things that have like fallen away.
Yeah.
So there's like a degree, like it's like there's some kind of like degrees of progression.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm just saying that out loud in case anyone's like looking at this and they're like, "Oh, I shouldn't even try."
No, I'm glad you said that because I mean, I go through this a lot where I, you know, my yoga teacher try as best as I can to live
right.
It. Sometimes I fail, oftentimes, and so I really like my apartment. I really like my boyfriend. I really like. Sometimes I like shopping. Not to excess, but like, and I feel bad. I feel guilty.
I think we had a pretty extensive discussion on this
point,
didn't we?
Well, you mean the, are you referring to?
The point we had is that we discussed that people have needs on this platform. We discussed that. That we have needs on this platform to be peaceful in mind, to actually progress in spiritual development.
But I guess what I'm referring to is actually really like it, enjoying these things.
What's that?
The things. Really enjoying the things. Or not wanting them to go away. I guess it's the attachment that I'm...
No, but we made that point also, didn't we? That we don't live to enjoy, we enjoy to live. Right? We don't eat to live. Right? We don't live to eat, we eat to live. So we actually discussed that pretty extensively. Right? That there's an objective, there's a goal. Well, this is describing Parama Prema, the highest love. Right? And the attainment of it and the achievement, because really what sadhana means practice, right? You can't practice unless you have a sadhya or a goal. Right? You're practicing towards a goal. So you have to describe what the goal is if you're going to have any practice towards it. And we also discussed that point is that, you know, guilt is debilitating, but humility is elevating. So we may be in a particular spot, particular place, and we're moving towards that. But it has to be based on a goal. And what sambandha gyan is, what real proper knowledge is, metaphysical knowledge. What sambandha gyan, real metaphysical knowledge is it's balanced knowledge. And I discussed also that bhakti is not renunciation. Bhakti is dedication. Right? And what renunciation is you give up the things that cannot be used. Right? Remember I mentioned a watch. 100 rupees. Right. So, okay, we're going to go to the next section, definition of bhakti. Now we define bhakti with reference to various different theories about it. Bhakti basically means absorption. How bhakti works is we're averse to being what we are as a servant of God. So basically it's kind of turning away. There's even a verse that says, Ishad upe tasya vipariyo smithi. How does it begin? Ishad upe tasya. When you turn away from God, you turn away from yourself, because what we are is part of God. So when you turn away from yourself, you assume another identity. Vayam dutiyabhi, and from that arises duality, fear, so many things. So what bhakti basically means is you turn your consciousness back.
Right? And when you turn your consciousness back, it brings out the natural relationship in the heart. And that's what bhakti is. Bhakti is two things, really, because it's the practice and the goal. The goal is bhakti, and how do you do it? You practice bhakti. So it means like a child. A child tries to walk, right? So he's trying to walk. He's trying to do the perfect thing. But the trying to walk brings out the walking capacity, right? So we try to turn to God, like a child walking, right? It starts to bring out the natural capacity within us to do so. So maybe that's another way of looking at that. When we're describing love, we're describing pure love. That's the objective. So we have to practice it. So we have to practice being... Now, this is, I think, the distinction. You can practice pure love, but it doesn't mean renunciation. It means dedication. So it's a realistic thing. You understand where you're at, and then you give yourself fully. And as Lakshmi Nisringa was explaining, it's not giving up attachment. It's offering everything to God. So at the same sense, it's what it says here. You know, it's turning your consciousness to God and embracing your position. But now, okay, here it is. It's all in the hands. Look at this. You're identifying here, right? So now how do you serve? How do you give everything to God? Right? Because this is what you're identifying with. You have these desires. So pure devotional service means not that you give up the desires, you dedicate them to God. I want a family. You know what I'm saying? It's coming from this platform, not from the soul. But you raise a family for God. I like to do business. So you do business and give some of the fruits to God. So whatever you do, it still can be in that spirit of the intention to please within the limitation of what you are right now. Right. For example, you like to eat. So it's very interesting. You don't have to give up eating. But, or eating nice things even. But it's a whole different consciousness when the food is offered in devotion and then taken in devotion. Bhakti has sensual experiences. It has sensual experiences, but in love. And I give the example of a mother. The mother cooks for the child. The mother cooks for the child, and the child... Mother loves the child, and the mother tastes the food. But the mother's sensual experience is love. Because she's tasting how her child is enjoyed. So obviously we may not be at that platform immediately, or whatever it is. But it's very practical. It's not renunciation, actually. In the whole Bhagavad Gita, if you read it, Arjuna was told to fight in the war because he had to protect people. So that was his duty. And this is the answer. Arjuna surrendered to Krishna fully. Right? He said, Sishaste Maham, I surrender to you fully. Okay, now Krishna said, okay, you're a warrior and your duty is to protect people. Now fight. So you see, it's not renouncing his desires, but he surrendered fully. Right? So when someone surrenders fully, it doesn't mean, okay, now you give up everything and, you know. But you do it in a spiritual way. And part of the spiritual way is your own needs and desires. Right? But we also discussed that before. Maybe the philosophy will reveal to you that some things are in excess and not good for you. But it won't tell you to deny needs and desires you have. but it may reveal to you, right, that certain things have to change and move in that direction. And it's, and how does that renunciation happen in bhakti? It's not no, 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 no. Because when you become full of love, then the fervors and things reduce. But it's not that you start, you hear the philosophy and say, give up everything. But what this is saying, as it is becoming filled up with love, your other needs reduce naturally. It's very, very practical. Right? You understand? Same sense of purity. I want to surrender and give myself fully. But what you have to give is what you have. And it includes your desires, your proclivities, etc. But, and different people have different needs. There's even a story. This is a story in Chaitanya Charitamrita. Gadadhar, he was one of Lord Chaitanya's associates. And Mukunda was a great devotee. He said, I want you to meet this Pundarik Vidyanidhi. This Pundarik Vidyanidhi. And he came to see him. I'll sing a song that they once sang about a bogus guru. Rubies, diamonds, rings, and pearls just attract fools to the spiritual world. Dashing, handsome, and carefree, such and such Goswami. It's about a real person. But what happened is that this person was on a silk bedstead, and you know, he had diamonds and jewels and like, and then they said that people looked at him, and this Gadadhar said, wait a second, he can't be a spiritual person. And then someone started to sing a song. Radha Krishna Pranamora capacity, has different needs. They realistically understand them. And then if that's what satisfies them, right, and they have strength, then they may dedicate themselves to God fully. Right? But at the same time, as your heart becomes filled with love, as you become filled with knowledge, you'll begin to realize, right, that you'll want to reduce your material necessities because they entangle you further and further. Right? So many things that we have, what happens is we have to work so hard for them that we don't have time for actual nurturing of the soul.
I know.
So you understand, Rin, is that clear now?
Oh yeah, I just wanted to make that point in case anybody, because I mean when I read the stuff about like where you could be, or I look at people like Achyuta and Ananta, and I'm like, John, I was telling you.
No, but you know, Ananta is it's a very practical example. You know, he's a bit of a sportsman, and he works out, and you know, he has a body that has those needs, and you know what I'm saying? And he's happy and peaceful and gives himself completely to kirtan. Mm-hmm. And in Chuta, you know, it's very dashing, and she likes clothes, and she's always got something. That's fine. But they take what they need, and no more. And different people have different needs. So I'm saying that. It's like that with bhakti in the same sense. But at the same time, as your heart becomes filled more and more with love, and there's different... See, I'm a monk. Lakshmi is married. The fact that I've taken a proclivity towards myself, towards a kind of a renounced type of life, doesn't make me more advanced. What's more advanced is the love and devotion in one's heart. That's what makes a person advanced in spiritual life. But on the path of jnana and yoga, you cannot become perfect unless you become completely celibate and give up the world. On the real path of yoga, if you read the Yoga Sutras, you don't do, not even the minimum advanced steps, you don't do if you're in faith. But in bhakti, you see, in bhakti, you're not meditating on that. You're meditating on serving God. So part of that is the desires and the things that you have. But when your heart becomes filled with love, Vishyavanigarta, you get a higher taste and other things become reduced. Okay? So here it says, we define love with variance to various theories about it. It is fondness for worship of the beloved. So that says parasa sandhyasa. So what that means, these are just different ways. This is, you can serve in different ways. There's one verse, ihaya shahaya dasye karmana manasa gira. It means karmana with your work, your mind, and your words. So karmana means your work. So it says here, anurag puja, you worship. And we describe what worship is. It's orienting matter around you to invoke a spirit of service in your heart. Because what's our relationship with the world? Generally, we see everything for our own selfishness. Right? Now we see everything in relationship to the deity. We see everything in relationship to God. Okay, let me describe one more concept here to help you understand bhakti, and then we'll finish this section. This is the 15th hour, so the clarity gets down. It's like the like one of those old dance marathons. You're still on the floor. I mean, it's like late at night, and I'm seeing it's time to kind of shift into other things besides philosophy. Basically, you can describe bhakti like this. First, you have to have a conception, the right conception. The conception is there's God and God's energies, right? Then you have to have a means to realize it. That's bhakti or devotion. You turn yourself, because you turn yourself towards the divine. And then there's a goal. The goal is realizing reality. And what realizing reality means is loving it. When you become free from illusion and you're very advanced in spiritual life, you actually see reality. And reality is God's and God's energies. And then you feel your relationship with it. And your relationship with another is called prema or love. So the prayojana or the goal is love. And the way that love happens, and one way to look at bhakti, is you start turning yourself towards bhakti and absorption. In terms of seva, what does seva do? Service, we discussed it. You start to see everything, and it changes. Because generally, this is how karma yoga works. Karma yoga works means you're in this mood. I am the center and I want to enjoy everything for myself. Right? So what karma yoga means, you have that force that you're going to satisfy your desires. Okay, so what you do is you take things for yourself and you give some of the results to God. So what happens when you do that? Like, you're a businessman. So you're working for yourself, you're making money, you're working for the money, but then you give some of the money to altruistic activities. So what happens when you give the results of your activities to the divine? You start seeing God's energy as His. And that's, what is illusion? Illusion simply means that you cannot see things in relationship to what it belongs to, which is the divine. You see them in relationship to yourself. You're seeing every... So how do you get rid of that? Well, okay, you're so attached to the things, then work for them, but give some of the result to the divine. And then you'll see that what that actually is belongs there. And when you get free from that misconception of separateness, and you actually see what's there, you begin to feel it. And that's called prema or love. And when one actually has the highest stage, he sees the divine everywhere. And he feels it everywhere. So this is what he's saying over here. These are the ways you do it. You do it with your work, karmana, anuraj puja. One way you could do it is take objects and redirect them towards God. Then the next verse says for discussion of the beloved, its fondness now for discussion of the beloved. You like to hear and talk. So karmana, manasagira, words. So another person says what devotion is you start to change what you talk about. Machita makita prana bodhiyantas paraspara. You start to change what you're talking about. The main expression of love is to glorify. Right? If any of you had any infatuation in your life, do you remember you couldn't stop talking about that person? And if you're married or with someone else, don't do that.
So did you say that taking things for the self but then giving the results
What's
to God?
That?
Did you say that taking things for yourself but then giving the results to God was okay?
I'm saying it's called karma yoga. Uh-huh. It means you have a desire, right? Mm-hmm. And you're not able to transcend it. Otherwise, you see what will happen is, this is just common. Let's say you have a strong desire. If you renounce it artificially, you think more of it. Right? Yeah. If you indulge in it, you think more of it. Isn't it? So, what a proper society does, it regulates it. It's just like sex life. If it's without restriction, it brings you into material consciousness. If you artificially renounce it, it brings you into things. So, in a proper society, it's regulated. You know, that's why there's marriage. Things like eating, right? If you eat and just, you know, open the refrigerator and snack, and I remember when I was young, it's amazing. You'd eat dinner at 6, and then I'd have ice cream at 7, and then your consciousness will be externalized. But then if someone says, oh, you know, I'm going to fast and just eat, you know, lettuce. Then they'll be meditating on ice cream 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
So then what people do is things are regulated. And what regulation does according to Dharma, what regulation does is you're practicing austerity, so you're being purified because you're only taking things at certain times. Like a spiritual person, what he does is he eats certain foods at certain times. So he's regulating that himself. Right? So you're satisfying yourself enough that the mind is not going to the object, and you're renouncing it enough so that you're being purified of it. I mean, there's so much in the philosophy that we cover in like 15 hours. But the basic conception of bhakti were there. So then he says, then another person says, removing blockage of the soul's inner affection. Because it means we naturally love God. Right? So you actually take away those things that block that energy. That's bhakti.
Jason's calling me.
What?
Jason's calling me.
Who? Jason?
Yeah.
Okay, it's about the drama? I can do it myself. I think I will. And then finally, Narada says, it's giving every endeavor to him and feeling supreme anguish into getting it. And then, basically, one says work, one says words, one says a mind, and one says no, to give everything. Okay, I'm going to actually... I really feel that we're on the edge of what we can do, on the both from the standpoint of the teacher and the student. Right? But I think we got the basic ideas. And this idea that Bryn brought up should just be very, very clear, that every practice has to have a goal. But in bhakti, the goal and the practice are the same. It's to love God and surrender. So it's not that automatically you start at a pure platform. And you describe the gradual progression as the experience intensifies. It begins with appreciation. Okay, come on in. Okay. So we're wrapping up. I hope I have everyone here now. Okay. We're describing that bhakti, it begins with appreciation. It increases to wanting to be with the devotees. But nishtha, becoming fixed, is an advanced stage. And that's when ruchi is. That's when real taste is in bhakti. It's like water. When is water really tasted? When it's just water. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, I am the taste of water. I never knew what that meant until I went to the Himalayas and I tasted the water coming right over the thing. So same thing with bhakti. When it's not mixed, when it's pure, when the intention is pure, then the real taste is there. But it has not. But it doesn't mean that you have to be renounced from the world and even your desires. It's just an intention. Here's the way I am. Here's the way I feel. I want to purely serve God. Okay, now what do I do? Right? Well, these are the desires. These are how I engage them. For the service of God. So the intention is still pure. This tension is still pure, even though there's desires. So in here, it's describing its divine love, its selfless intention. That doesn't mean renunciation. It means dedication, whatever you give it. And then you gradually advance, and then you come to nishtha. You become fixed. Okay, it's what I'm discussing with the group now is that both for the teacher and the audience is right now. I mean, in the evening, it becomes a little bit more difficult, and it's been like going. Actually, this group has gone maybe like 9 hours straight or something. You know, 3 hours or 3 hours yoga, 3 hours day. Okay, we got to do the drama and do something a little bit. Okay, let me just tell basically another way in which bhakti comes in the heart is by appreciating those who have it. Voltaire says, that which you appreciate belongs to you. And you'll see that in your life. Who are your exemplars? What their qualities are will come to your heart. That's why one of the most important things in bhakti is to have sadhu sangha. Now, in terms of, and I really feel that I can't get into a long explanation of this, but there's a whole history in India of the relationship between aesthetic experience, which is called rasa, and spiritual development. And there's even a Natya Shastra, a Shastra of drama. And it's a whole story that Indra comes to Brahma, and then Brahma sees that the people can't get rid of ego, and he says they need something visible and audible, and he says by drama, by rasa, this is the best way to cope with ego. So basically, this is the theory that he came up with. And he was very brilliant. It's 2,000 years ago, Bharat Muni. What he did is he studied human experience. And he saw that there were 8 emotions that were considered dominant. They were consuming. Romance. Tragedy. Fear. So he discussed these things. And he observed these emotions. What happened?
I just was looking at Jason to see if it feels like, I think someone's trying to get into our space, and I don't know if it was somebody for you.
I want one mind here, so you gotta come back. I can't lecture to two different, you know, it's a frame of reference if everyone has to be one. There's no one at the front desk?
None.
What?
None. We're the only ones in the studio now.
Oh. It's a theory of rasa, actually. It's a theory of rasa that the audience has to be one. Because then I'll be speaking to you, and then someone else comes in, and they don't have the same frame of reference. Go see if Prince coming. Tell her I can't speak with people running in and out, so I'm going to wait for her. Ask her how long she'll be. Oh, you're there? What's that?
It's like India. People just show up with prasadam.
What's that?
It was Amiya dropping off strawberries.
Okay. That's nice. You didn't invite her into the class?
She had to leave.
Okay.
She didn't want to stay. Son's birthday is tomorrow.
Okay, so. Okay, so he studied these dominant emotions. And then what he saw is he saw what are the players of those emotions, what is the setting of those emotions, what are the actions of those emotions, and what are the accessory emotions. Then he devised a dramatic theory where any of those emotions can be duplicated on the stage in such a way that the audience can feel them. It's a very elaborate dramatic theory. And what he felt was, is that the audience, what would happen to the audience, they would feel the emotion, right? But it wouldn't be a relationship to their ego. In other words, there'd be tragedy, they feel tragedy, but it wasn't really their tragedy. So they'd have this aesthetic experience. And for the duration of it, he said that people would step out of ordinary time and space, and that the same obstacles that prevent one from enjoying it are the same obstacles that maintain the illusion. And there's a whole theory that developed about it. Now, I can't go in and give a whole seminar on it. But so from that Natya Shastra, then different transcendentalists began to elaborate on this aesthetic theory. And they would feel that an audience, for example, this is why when people come in and out, you had to, what can you do? But what happens is, and one of the reasons why these groups, there's such an intense experience, because it creates one mind. And what happens is that experience of one mind enables people to get just some transcendence from the egotistical conception. Because it's a joint experience. And when I speak, and when you teach, what you do is you try to create one mind. And people are experiencing the same thing. It's just like one story where they came to see Lord Chaitanya and all the disciples loved him, and it described, they were gazing at him as if a single pair of eyes. So there's one mind, and it's called catharsis in Greek. There's some experience that happens that allows you to transcend, the self. They thought like this. And then there were elaborate. So they felt it was very healthy in society for people to be cultured and to have these aesthetic experiences and experience this direction towards transcendence, even if it wasn't transcendence. And some people thought it was transcendence. And it's a whole seminar. I gave it here, an hour and a half, 2 hours on this theory. But what we're going to go to now is what happened is, years after Bharat Muni, in the tradition that I belong, there was one incredible devotee, and he came up with this realization. He saw that all these, it's very, very elaborate, all these elaborate, like for you to actually have a drama that someone, a cultured person will appreciate, you have to have all these elements proper for each emotion. It's very complex. The proper players, who is experiencing that emotion, what is the setting that supports that emotion, what are the actions of that emotion, what accessory emotions fit. It's very, very elaborate in that way. So what this person saw, that 3,000 years before Bharat Muni, in the Bhagavatam, which discusses the pastimes of Krishna, it was perfectly composed by this elaborate aesthetic experience, a theory. But the dominant emotion was bhakti, or devotion. So what he said is that what bhakti is, and what the Bhagavatam is, and the pastimes of Krishna is, composed according to perfect rules of bhavas, how they create this incredible experience, this absorbing experience of bhakti, that was the experience of reality. Not just parody or recreating experiences in the world, but that was the spiritual experience, devotion. And that the Bhagavatam and Krishna's pastimes was a perfect aesthetic experience composed of love and selfless devotion to the highest degree. So after that, this Rupa Goswami, who was a poet par excellence, an incredible devotee, began to compose dramas and poems. And in our tradition, there's so many dramas, there's so many poems. Why? Because the drama would recreate that experience of bhakti perfectly based on the Bhagavatam, which is based on the ultimate reality. And the audience who was watching it, who had the appropriate culture and qualification, would experience those same things. One time in Vrindavan, I took two young punk musicians with me that were coming into spiritual life. And when we went there, what we did is, I took them around Vrindavan. So in Vrindavan, in that month of July, there are drama groups all over Vrindavan with Krishna's pastimes, musicals. I had a video. You see, if I was more tech thing, I'd put what you could, classical music and ragas and pastimes, and it's incredible. And so I brought these people, you know, but everything. So there's like these renounced widows and these babajis, they wear these short loincloths, and they're all sitting there watching the dramas and going with all the babas and things, and they call us to the front. Now, once you get in the front, it's a 5-hour thing. You can't go out. So these guys couldn't even sit cross-legged yet. They couldn't understand the language. But that's what it was. And the dramas and the poetry. And these people were such expert. They're called kavis. You may have a couple of good authors. You may have 100 good authors in 100 years. You may get 2 or 3 kavis. They are so masterful in words, you would not believe. If I could get this PowerPoint presentation I saw made of it, they would write poems in Sanskrit where the poem would say the same thing forwards and backwards, across and around. They would compose poems with one Sanskrit letter only, because when you combine it, they become other. So you got a poem go nina 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 nina, and it would be a whole thing about Krishna and his pastimes. They can do anything. They were cubbies. I had one god brother who actually was born in Brooklyn, actually, who learned Sanskrit, became a cubby. He wrote 30,000 sonnets. He was a Sanskrit pandit, and I was there when he left his body when he was dying. And when they rolled his body off, the day he died, he wrote 5 sonnets about Krishna's pastimes. So what I've done is, with a devotee who is a very professional, active graduate of Tisch School of Dramatic Arts, we wrote some dramas to help people both understand Krishna and perhaps put yourself in the mood of being receptive And hearing a drama that has these components of perfect love. Okay? Basically. So we're going to start the drama now. Maybe move the two people on the back there. And Jason's here because Jason's going to also be in the drama.
Thank you.
time? Was she second time?
Third.
What?
Third.
When you saw it with Alex that day, and you saw half of it at Radha, right?
Oh, that was only half. Right.
But it's supposed to get better every time. And because you're practicing bhakti, you should roll with all the bhaktis. Okay? Now, in this drama, I play the Sringa Vallabha Goswami. Okay? Who lives in Vrindavan. I'm also a Swami, so it parallels myself, but it's not actually myself. I will wait, and I'm going to have to warm up the crowd while goes and puts on his goatee. Okay. Yeah, this is the right activity for now. The philosophy was not... It was okay, but, you know, it's a little hard at night now.
If you wanted to read some of these past months, what would be the best book?
We're going to have time. The Krishna book. You can go to krishna.com, and there's a Krishna book. That's one of them, but...
In the last section of the training, you have the Bhagavatam.
What's that?
That secret book that Edward Ryan wrote, that nobody knows he wrote. It's like the Bhagavatam translation.
Yeah.
Is that a good one?
What's that?
Is that a good one?
It's scholarly. Krishna book is much better. I mean, he really, it's very, very scholarly. It's okay. Bless me that I'll remember the lines in the drama very well. Okay. Younger and the world was younger and our spirits were younger, I lived in the mystical land of Vrindavan, which I suppose too is younger, but really it's an ageless place. This was a city of magnificent temples, sadhus, sages, saintly widows, rich, colorful history. Monkeys. At the time, no cell phones or computers. But most importantly, it was the home of Krishna, his family, his friends, and his loved ones. I was charged with saving the ancient Vaishnav libraries. That's the Bhakti libraries. Libraries filled with musty old books, all but forgotten tunes. They contain deep and esoteric passages of spiritual history and wisdom. In such a library previously belonging to Prime Krishna Baba, it seemed that all the books were far too damaged by time or lack of proper care to be salvageable. I was prepared to abandon the collection, but then I saw one book lying on the floor. I immediately picked it up, knowing that regardless of its condition or title, no such spiritual text should be residing on the floor. To my amazement, it was in near perfect condition. I turned the cover and glanced at the first page. Hari Lila Bakash, 17th century, scribe by Sri Damodar Bahulanath. I had never heard of the author, but as I read on, I found that his claims and insights were remarkable. He claimed to be a 17th century descendant of one of Krishna's most intimate associates, Vasant. His great, 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 great grandson, and so on. Hari Lila Prakash tells the exploits, the friendly exploits of the Vasant with Krishna and the beautiful surroundings. It actually tells the friendly exploits of Krishna and the beautiful surroundings of the Vrindavan forest. My friends, my hands were shaking. The hair on my neck was standing on end. I realized I was holding a precious jewel. It was as if the book wanted me to find it. Among the most fascinating aspects of Hari Lila Prakash is an excerpt found in the appendix entitled Krishna Lila, that means pastimes, activities, a reasonable conception of divinity. Sri Damodar's lifelong concern was that people would think the pastimes of Krishna fables and mundane. Listen to his ideas. I think you will find them significant. Sri Damodar Bahulanath writes, all of us are seeking pleasure, and our greatest pleasure is found in pure, unmotivated love. If pure love is our guiding and universal principle, then why should not it be part of its source, the ultimate reality? Got that? If love is our guiding universal principle, why should it not be part of its source, the ultimate reality? As pure love entails a mutual exchange, then the one harmonious truth must have a type of discrimination within it. There must be personality, beauty, and other qualities that enhance the flow of love. One harmonious truth must have a discrimination for love. This flow of love is known as Shakti or energy. And like all energy, devoted to bringing pleasure to its source. Thus the Vaishnava conception of reality is divine Leela, a drama that stages the perfect exchange of pure love, an exchange of devotion between the source of all energy, Sri Krishna, and the supreme Shakti, Radha. My friends, I felt like weeping. Such a deep concept, but expressed in such simple terms. I now understood why the great Vaishnav teachers thus write of rasa, the height of divine love. as that which we appreciate gradually belongs to us by relishing these divine leelas or stories, the same causeless love gradually awakens in our heart. Sri Damodar Bahulanath continues, and just as love and pleasure to be appreciated to its fullest requires a variety of loving exchanges, why should not friendship, parental affection, and the love of secret and intimate dalliance not exist in its pure sense in the divine realm? I should explain for those who don't know, Krishna is a cowherd that takes care of his father's cows. This job afforded him the task to deeply befriend other boys occupied with the same task. They would gallivant all over Vrindavan, playing in its fields, resting in the shade of its trees, sharing wonderful meals, all the while deepening their mutual affection and admiration. But in Vrindavan, as everywhere else, there are those that are opposed to even a trace of the flow of love. Demons. But if you think about it, if you think about it deeply, don't those challenges to love only increase its affection? Did you ever fear the loss of a loved one? Was it not at those times that the flow of love reached its height? That's why I'm so excited to share Hari Lila Prakash with you. It tells the stories of such perfected love. Maybe I have time for one. First, a little background. One day, the waters of the Jamuna were visited by a multi-headed serpent named Kaliya. He was poisoning the water with the stench and fumes emanating off his hideous body, causing anyone drinking or even visiting the waters to immediately die. Beautiful, oh beautiful Krishna would not stand for such a travesty. For the demon was threatening the livelihood and wonder of his home, his friends, his family, and his loved ones. So he decided to take the matter into his own hands, and as you can imagine, caused inconceivable grief for the residents of Vrindavan who loved him more than his very life. Imagine how they felt. No, don't imagine. Hear, my friends. It would not be fair for me to keep the treasure of the insights of Sri Damodar Bahulanath to myself. Let us hear an account from a witness to Krishna's feats that day on the bank of the Jamuna. Listen carefully, for anyone who hears these stories with faith and attention, the same causeless love awakens in their hearts. Sri Damodar Bahulanath writes, upon returning home late one day from the forest, after Krishna's horrifying and then glorious struggle with the Kaliya serpent, I, the son, an intimate friend of Krishna, met his anxious mother waiting at the door with a stick in her hand.
Mother, mother, I just seen the most amazing... No, I know I'm late, but... No. Mother, I didn't do this on purpose. No, I was with Krishna. Yes, Krishna. Yeah, we were in trouble. Well, he was in trouble. And me and my friends were in trouble, too. Will you listen without punishing me, Mother? I've seen the most amazing thing. Well, we were out in the field, and we were remarking how it was so nice that Krishna and Balaram had taken care of those nasty demons in the Taliban forest. Because now, all the fruits were ripe, and they could be picked, and all the sweet animals could run and frolic, and they weren't... Why am I late, Mother? Well, right. With the warm sun shining, it was so bright, and after working and walking so hard, that we were very thirsty. So Krishna said to follow him to the Yamuna. So we followed him to the Yamuna, and as we followed him, we could watch his beautiful footprints in the sand. And then, when we reached the Yamuna, we could see that we were so thirsty that we just jumped down and started drinking the water. We were very parched. But what we hadn't noticed, Mother, was that the water was poisoned. I know, it sounds terrible, Mother, but listen, I'm alive now. Well, not that I was dead before. I don't think. But as we were drinking the water, I turned and looked at all the other cowherd boys, and they were writhing on the ground. And when I took what I thought was going to be my last breath, a warmth flowed through me. And a love started to fill my heart. And then just as I was about to close my eyes, Mother, I woke to see Krishna's smiling face. And then I started to feel better. And I looked at the other boys and they were better. And we didn't know, but somehow Krishna had protected us. If only every moment of awakening was so filled with such a happy sight, Mother. Oh no, that's not the end of the story, Mother. It gets much better. Would you like to hear the rest of the story? Are you very well? Good. Does this mean that I'm not in trouble? No. This part is scary. Yes, because we looked into the water to see if we could find out what had made it so deadly. And the most frightening image, Mother, this huge snake with skin black as night and eyes red as flame. And it was spewing clouds of nightmares from its nostrils. It was swimming in the Yamuna, Mother. I was frozen solid because the air around the moon was so foul, Mother, and all the lush grass was starting to turn brittle. It was a very dangerous place to be. I saw a bird flying overhead, Mother, and I told it, no, 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 turn back, stop. But as soon as it hit this foul air, Mother, it dropped down dead. And there was nothing we could do. And I turned to look at my friends to see, and their faces said the same thing that I felt. Everybody, except Krishna, he looked angrier than I'd ever seen him, Mother. I didn't know what he intended to do, but already his bravery was lessening than my fear. And I could see in his face, he was thinking, serpent, how dare you poison these waters where me and my cowherd boys play? How dare you ruin this grass where we've rested so many times? And what he did, Mother, was he climbed up one of these dead kadamba trees. And when he got to the very top, he caught it. His claw, as if he was about to do something. And then, he started to wave his arms like this. And And then, Mother, we left him for a while. Mother, I notice other people are listening to my story. I can see that my words have attracted the saintly souls of Vrindavan. These men and women, they were there, Mother. They can tell you if my story was true. Which reminds me, why were you not at the Yamuna, Mother? A cow was injured? A baby cat? I can see you're in despair, Mother, but that's one of our most sacred duties, is Catholic protection. I was hit by a flaming rock falling from the sky. I know why, Mother. I know why. Yes, because Krishna was in trouble. Yes, when Krishna jumped into the water, he created a splash so large, Mother, that we couldn't see anything. And for a moment, we had to just cover our eyes. But then, when the water started to recede, we looked up, and that Kadamba tree that he had jumped from, that I swear to you was dead 5 minutes before, now had beautiful yellow flowers on it. So Krishna swam in the water towards this many-headed serpent, and he was splashing the water, Mother, and he was yelling out. And it was so loud, Mother, that I wanted to cover my ears, but it sounded so much like the songs that Krishna would sing when he was going through the forest, when all the birds were accompanying him. It was so sweet and melodious, Mother. But this didn't seem to bother the serpent. It enraged him. Yes, he was getting more angry and more angry as he swam towards him. But how could you be angry at Krishna? Mother, what happened next is very frightening. As Krishna approached the snake, he came up and, like lightning, he smashed and bit Krishna right on the chest, and he wrapped him in his coils. I dropped my knees. Was Krishna dead? The cows began to wail. Rocks of flame started to fall from the sky. Krishna, all of these residents from Vrindavan came to the banks of the moon and they wanted to know what was happening. Everybody, even Mother Yashoda came. And as she came in desperation, and all of the women had to stop her from jumping into the poisonous waters. Just standing in their arms. It was a sight so scary, Mother. I never wish to see it again. And the only thing that could comfort her was retelling the glories of Krishna. And then no one rushed. And he tried to jump in the water as well. But everybody stopped him, especially Balaram. And he didn't know what to do. Krishna was wrapped in his coils. So we prayed. We prayed for somebody, something to save Krishna. And then, I noticed something, Mother. Balaram was smiling. A moment of desperation. Balaram was smiling as if he knew something was going to work out. So we prayed and prayed and prayed and we waited until all the lovely saints of Vrindavan came to the banks and all the animals and the creatures were waiting. And then, Krishna freed himself from the snake. The wonders of wonders, Mother. With a single bow, he jumped up and he jumped on the top of the snake. And then he began to dance. He began to dance, Mother. It was the most beautiful dance. And the snake was trying to bite him and bite him. And all he kept doing was dance. And on top of his head. I could never hope to dance like this, Mother. But it was so beautiful because the rays of the sun were shining. And the snakes had these beautiful jewels on the tops of its head. And it looked like Krishna's feet were sparkling. Because every time one of his head was trying to bite him, he would jump and dance out of the way. Celestial musicians started to play. They must have been so pleased with this dancing that they started to play to make everything look better. It was so beautiful, Mother. But then the snake kept trying to bite him. but he was getting tired. So you started to spew things at him. He started to spew blood and vomit. And it's... but it looked... actually, it looked kind of like garlands. Like he was offering prayers at his lowest feet. And then just when we thought he was done, all the wives of the snake came to the shore, and they were very disheveled by him. And what they said was this. They said that their husband must have had many lives of piety if he now had Krishna's lotus feet on his head. I thought this was the most beautiful prayer. And Krishna stopped. And he ordered the snake to leave and to never return to Vrindavan again. You see, Mother, this is why I was late. I hope that you're not upset with me, Mother. It's just that my friend Krishna. I hope that you'll forgive me. You can tell the story over and over forever.
Rade, Rade, Govinda, our guiding principle, then why should we deny
And if it's in the ultimate reality, love requires an exchange. So that one harmonious truth, which everyone agrees about, must have a type of discrimination. There must be personality, beauty, and other qualities to enhance the flow of love. And this flow of love is known as Shakti, or energy. And like all energy, devoted to bringing pleasure to its source. If there's energy, energy serves its source. Every energy you have, whether it's jnana, knowledge, bala, strength, kriya, sensual activity, it's to please. The essence of pleasure there, or the essence of energy or shakti, is love. So if there is actually shakti, there has to be love. And then finally, therefore, the Vaishnava conception of reality is a drama that stages the perfect expression of love. Now, we just try to do something very, very simply. But if you actually study it beyond the externals, and I have my book outside, Waves of Devotion, the exchanges that happen, for example, Krishna is in the Kaliya serpent. So the first aspect of love is called Stai Bhav. You have a particular relationship with conception. So let's say Krishna is mother. Don't look at it anything external. So what happens to the mother? Krishna is in trouble. So she comes to the shore of the river, right? And she sees her son. Bahar Bidam Natavarabhu Karniyo Karnikaryam Bhadrisha. He has a peacock feather. It's right in my mind. I just said the verse, and now I went, Bahar Bidam, Natavra, the most like Karniyo Karni, beautiful to us, just beautiful, the exquisite beauty of. And what happens to her love when she sees? And then she sees that he's in trouble, so what happens? Fear comes. Right, anxiety. What's happening to the love? It's just heightening and heightening and heightening. And then she sees her son, and then she becomes stunned and she faints. And what happens to her love? It's increasing, increasing, increasing. So it's a description actually about how Shakti and energy works in a way to increase the sense of love or affection or selflessness. And if you read these stories and get beyond the externals, you'll find that this is there. Now, the conception of Krishna is very, very beautiful. I gave the description yesterday of Gabriel. So initially, I just met her. She was someone in there. And she was a stranger. I didn't know her. Right? So, was I seeing Gabriel? You can't see Gabriel unless you know her. So she said something nice about the class, and I commented on her nice southern accent. It's like, when a lady say, yes sir, no sir. I'm joking, but we exchanged, and then she showed me more of herself. I'm not seeing the same person. And then she has other relationships that are very intimate, and more comes out. So there's a concept here of Krishna, which is called the Kila Rasa Rita Murti, the full embodiment of love. As Lakshmi was saying, it must be infinite. Within that infinite sense is a sense of personality. The absolute reality doesn't have the defect of impersonality. You give yourself someone, you serve them, and how do you like it if they don't respond? It's called impersonal. So the concept is as the bhakti, as the devotion gets deeper and deeper, more and more of the beauty of the absolute reality is revealed. What happens is, and it's a very interesting concept, position covers personality. If I was sitting as a high court judge and you were in the court, and even if you respected me as a very, very high person, to satisfy your relationship, I would have to cover most of my person with my position. Because you only had a relationship of reverence and awe. I'd have to cover my personality. Most of me you wouldn't see. You wouldn't see, let's say, I was married. You wouldn't see me as a lover. You wouldn't see me as a friend. You wouldn't see me as a parent or a child. So the concept of Krishna is that there's one God. When he has to take that role and position, he has to cover most of his sweetness to satisfy those who want to worship in reverence. So Krishna means when God is not covered by position. Why is he covered by it? Because then his full self can come out. When you're God, everything gets covered. Your nature as... So, what we're trying to show there is that these aspects... So Krishna means, literally, it is one God. Don't get confused. According to the approach, there may be different perspectives, different names. But the beautiful concept of Krishna is when God's not covered by position. And the friendship and the love and all these things come out. And Radha, wow, at this time of night, they're going to Radha. I'll just go briefly. I gave another seminar here. What?
I know I missed
it. But it's on tape. On the Yoga Maya, Radha, her stories and philosophy, my lecture she put on tape. But so anyway, don't get Prajumna asked me also, why so late? They have, I said, you know, they have to work, there's other classes, they don't know what they have. I should have taken the yoga class, actually. You'll see me in my yogi pants. I'll take your class drink, because that will give me energy. Don't get confused by any externals. We had a conception. The absolute reality, consciousness, and everything is inclusive, doesn't have the defect of impersonality. And the beauty of love that we see here must be manifest in that reality, in perfection. And these stories and pastimes that people listen to are perfectly composed, and when people listen the right way, that sending of selflessness and love comes into their life. I was going to say, I'll sing at least one line of that song there. I'll show you. Can we do that, Karen?
Sure.
And then we can...
We can end early. You don't have to like.
Well, what about the extra 30 minutes that they don't get on the teacher training?
Who wants time to tailor? Who will sign in to listen to Sri Radha?
Thank you.
Had some final notes that I wrote down, if I can find my notes. My notes are over there. Okay, I'm not my room. Someone just give me a blank piece of paper or two. Okay. Just going to read a short story from one of my books. It's not even a short story, it's a paragraph. And it's describing how you can see in the world, by your own perception, if you look very carefully, you'll see the same things that are mentioned in the Shastra. So I give an example how just one day, in looking in the world, I saw something that impressed me. In this regard, I learned a very important lesson from observing Bhakta Herman. I'm in Vrindavan. As I was leaving the temple this morning, an older monk came by to offer a garland from the South African disciples of Parthasarathi Prabhu, who's standing nearby. So one of my godbrothers had his disciples offer me a garland. And they did it through this monk. I was intrigued by this monk who introduced him as Bhakta Herman. Bhakta Herman was in his late 50s, not much taller than 5 feet, and somewhat crippled in both feet. Although he could walk without a cane, he struggled terribly, like a devotee blistered on both feet from walking around the dham. His disability, however, was obviously permanent, either congenital or a result of a serious accident or disease. His jaws were also constantly gnawing, either from pain or a nervous disorder. He had a strong South Brooklyn accent and a fairly serious speech disorder that further slurred his already strong accent into an almost childish and squeaky tone. I began a conversation with this likable and humble soul. "Where are you from, Prabhu?" "I stay 6 months of the year in Berkeley," he said, "and 6 months in Vrindavan." "What do you do?" "I mop floors and wash pots." His service was so menial that I almost felt embarrassed to have asked him. But from the tone of his response, I can sense his absence of false prestige. He wasn't bothered at all by my questions. "Where were you born?" I continued. "Coney Island in Brooklyn." "You know where that is?" "Coney Island? I'm from Cropsey Avenue. Coney Island is less than 15 minutes away." A rapport was developing. "Yeah, that's just over the bridge." I continued our pleasant conversation and can see that he was from the most humble background. I began to recall fond memories from my childhood of my grandmother taking me to Coney Island, which at the time was the most prominent amusement park in New York. It was a big treat for me, but even as a young child, I could sense that Coney Island, like all amusement parks, was meant for visiting, not living, at least decently. "How do you like Krishna consciousness, Herman?" His face lit up. "I don't know why, but I get such nectar comes." All of a sudden, nectar. With each nectar, his heart became lighter and his face became brighter. Dr. Herman was very sincere. He was definitely expressing something wonderful in Krishna consciousness. I learned from Herman the relationship between renouncing false prestige and attaining devotion. Herman didn't have much, but that made him dependent on Krishna. We are all dependent, but unfortunately our assets like wealth, beauty, intelligence, or birth give us a false sense that we're controlling the world independently of God. We thus lose the sense of dependence needed to approach the Lord feelingly, to approach Him with real devotion. I pray to become free like from false ego, the illusory conception of being independent of God, so I can feelingly approach God. And now I'm going to read one paragraph. That's a book I wrote called Greetings from Vrindavan. And it was journals I wrote because I was in India and I was trying to help people in America I knew. And I started to write these journals and send them by email. And someone said, "Wow, you've got a great blog." I didn't know what a blog was. I was just writing emails and sending around, and then someone said, "Put it in a book." So it's meant for people that had the frame of reference at the time. So sometimes some words and phrases wouldn't be if I kind of gave it to an outside audience. But I also met people who had deep realizations. I wanted to share them with others, so I began writing. And my own experiences, and a little bit also from when I was traveling in New York. And then I'll be going, and I go to this place, Govardhan. And what I do is I take a Nam Vrata for 1 month. Bryn was in my place. It's a very nice, right, mud walls, and very nice place. And she knows the potency of that place because I took her and her friend Amy with Akinchana, the four of us. And Akinchana had lost his voice. I can't sing anyway. And so we were there, and we got to this Govardhan Hill. I took him into this ancient place where these Siddha Mahatmas for hundreds of years used to perform just chanting God's names hours and hours. And then Bryn and Amy were just so enthusiastic in their chanting. These monks came out, and they, you know, they're really pure. You know, it's not like, "Oh, some Western ladies are here. Let us look." They were just clapping and clapping and appreciating. And that was one of the most memorable kirtans we had there. It was beautiful. So in that place, so I would write my realizations of chanting. So I'll read one. Yogic chanting one. Focus on the holy name, stop the mind, reveal the soul. Yoga, in its classical definition, is not a philosophy or worldview, but a psychosomatic process. The mind is a mirror for a bounded soul to observe its consciousness, to see its soul. When the mirror is dirty, the image is distorted. We see a controller, not a servant, and don't feel the soul. Devotion and bliss. The dust is our material thoughts, decisions, and self-conceptions. Stop that, and the pure soul is reflected in the mind. So I focus on the name, stop the mind, reveal the soul, and feel relief. What a relief. Our only relief, basking in the soul. But the dust of the mind, the sense of not being the soul, says no. Let me be the enjoyer and controller and suffer. How unfortunate. I'm saying that because just before we go, each person, I'd like to give a gift because you've been such an incredible audience. So I'd like, you can choose one of the books or another. Okay? And let me just also, I'll get the tapes. I'm also going to get some of them edited and the full, between me and Bryn, and Chloe's going to take the responsibility of kind of getting them together. That's her seva, her service. And then we can, so you can also listen to that. And I'm going to be writing now a commentary on the Narada Bhakti Sutras. And I'm going to get a new website. It's being made now. And it's going to be posted on the Facebook page that one student of mine keeps for me. So probably within a week or two, every week, there'll be one of the verses out with a commentary on the verse so that you can continue studying the Narada Bhakti Sutras. I also happen to be giving class on my phone Sangha. So I'm going to give you the information now of my website. And you're also free to... you're free to write me any questions. I learned one thing in India. A sadhu, they should be open. That's their duty. That's their seva, to try to realize something and share it. So my website is wavesofdevotion.com. Yeah, sure. Now what is it now? I know, oh, but that, yeah.
I'm going to wash
them. I'm going to hand them out. Yeah, good. Thank you. Wavesofdevotion.com. Okay. My email, you just put a DDS. I'm not a dentist. It's my name, Dhanadhar Swami, DDS. Okay. I always welcome feedback for the class, how to improve it, etc. Anybody has any ideas? And if you'd like to be on my mailing list, okay, I give updates when the new journals are coming out. I can also inform you of, actually speaking, if I'll do this, you can write info@wavesofdevotion.com. If you want to find out about the phone classes that I give, they can put you on a list for that. And if you want to be on the mailing list in my journal. And if you want to be invited to the programs, we have a program called Bhakti Experience. Even when I'm not here, we'll do it with that Lakshmi and his wife and Kastuba, the other teacher. We have it in a very, very nice place on East 95th Street and 3rd Avenue, like right near the 6th train. Generally we do it either Saturday or Sunday, either Sunday morning or Saturday afternoon. Know that most of you will be busy, but like sometimes you may be free. So you can, we'll just put it over there, and you can just write your name clearly. Okay, you can start, Lisa. Okay. And I'm waiting for the to hand out some prasada, because that's also proper. And Okay. Can you do this? Here. The books are here.
Raj, are you going to write them to the docs?
Oh! Thank you. Thank you. You have my email?
Yes.
Is this all I have here? I should have more. Okay. If anyone, I'm inviting you to Vrindavan. Anybody would like to go, just write me. And Bryn went just directly to Vrindavan. Also, I know people who take tours like Raghunath. Lisa's going on that. You're invited to come. And I can kind of guide your experience there if it's coordinated with the time that I get there, especially time where I'm taking people around. Okay?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Can we clap for the play?
What?
Yes. Yes.
Wait, I wish you would have done it right after.
Well, we started singing.
Yeah, that's good. It would have been good. Bring it here. Okay? Yeah. Okay, and this is also, we can hand out some prasad. Why don't you come up for prasad, then wash your hands, and then come back for a book. Thank you. Contact with the box me.
Yes, I have
Thank you. Thank you.
I have to go back.
If you want to go down here. Okay. If you could write on a piece of paper and give me.
Okay.
Sorry,
this is the
worst.
I don't know
if
there's a lot.
No, this is spontaneous.
Yeah, I think you get everything.